How's it going?
Oh, it's going. How about you?
Yeah, same. And that's I don't know. That's why I was in the mood for this writer for some reason. I don't know exactly why. I'm not like a super fan or anything, but I do appreciate it very much, so.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. Reese DJ Pancake's story collection was first published in 1983, 3 years after his death by suicide on one Palm Sunday after a spate of grievous losses in his life. Much has been written about Pancake's life, the middle initials in his unusual name, his feeling like an outsider in university and elsewhere. Some readers don't consider his life and work without also considering his death. But in life, he experienced a little bit of success, living to see his stories published in reputable publications like the Atlantic Monthly. His stories were set in West Virginia and always feature some focus on the natural world with hardworking characters in some sort of dire straits. Their lives are laid bare for readers bit by slow and thoughtful bit. There's a timelessness in Pancake stories. They're distilled, austere, compressed, and yet we find such a richness and complexity in them, in the interiority of the main characters, the conflicts they encounter, the losses they endure. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss First Day of Winter by Breece DJ Pancake, and stay tuned for a bonus episode about another story by Breece DJ Pancake called Time and Again.
Nobody seems to be able to talk about this writer without talking about his biography or his life story or whatever. And obviously it's in every word he wrote, but I want to talk about every word he wrote rather than the other stuff, even though there's some fascinating things, including his love for a songwriter, singer, Phil Oakes, who I didn't really listen to much in my life and been listening to him all morning. But anyway.
And I think I always notice it, but his first paragraphs. You know what? Stop, rewind. I do want to say something. I'm with you. Everything I've been reading about him is all about how he died. Everybody sort of goes to the same details about his life and his death, the missed opportunities, the potential, what could have been. You know, could we imagine stories from a much more mature Breece Pancake, and I like your idea about just looking at his own words in these stories.
Yeah, and I would just say a caveat to that because he was a really beloved teacher of mine. But what James Allen McPherson has to say about Pancake's death is extremely beautiful and, like McPherson, always going against the grain of like the thrust of where a story's going, you think it's going. And McPherson just has a way of telling the story of this suicide that I thought was just heartbreaking, and maybe we could circle back to it at some point. Just to say that, because I think he maybe should have the last word on Pancake's life and death.
So, but these first paragraphs, like the first paragraph in First Day of Winter, I don't suppose you'd want to read it out loud.
What is it about the first paragraphs?
So, it's so beautifully set up, and it's so beautifully set up in ways that hold so many things that are part of this place and part of these people and part of the problem for the character of Hollis. And of course, it's very concise, it's very compressed, beautifully so. I was just really taken with this one this time.
Yeah, I've always loved this story the best of them all, and I do love many of the stories in this book, but this one I think is how distilled this opening paragraph carries the story, characterizes the story, every line of it, I think, is so restrained and not forced. I think that's when he's at his very, very best. He doesn't mind an awkwardness in the line. He doesn't mind anything as long as he's just sort of like there with his characters. Hollis sat by his window all night, staring at his ghost in glass, looking for some way out of the tomb Jake had built for him. Now he could see the first blue blur of morning growing behind bare tree branches, and beyond them the shadows of the farm. The work was done. Silos stood full of corn. Hay bales rose to the barn's roof, and the slaughter stock had gone to market. It was work done for figures in a bank, for debts, but now corn stubble leaned in the fields among stacks of fodder laced with frost. He could hear his parents shuffling about downstairs for their breakfast, his old mother giggling, her mind half gone from blood too thick in her veins, his father now blind and coughing. He had told Jake on the phone they'll live a long time. Jake would not have his parents put away like furniture. Hollis asked Jake to take them into his parsonage at Harper's Ferry. The farm was failing. Jake would not have room. The parsonage was too modest, his family too large.
So you have the idea of Hollis in this, you know, the metaphor of the tomb that his brother has created the space for him to be stuck in. You see the absolute industriousness of Hollis because of the work that has been done, and then there are those details about it. You know that the idea about the bank, the debts, the looming debts, and then that the parents are old and they have health problems, and Jake doesn't live there, and he's not going to help Hollis by taking the parents in. And we even know what Jake does and where he lives and that he has a family of his own. It's like this whole world in this one paragraph.
Right. You know, and I think the reason we still read this writer is because he's one of those writers, one of those story writers who, you know, happen to out of the gate sort of get that you're not conveying information, but you're telling a story. And yet information is a story. And here you just recounted a lot of information, but it's because Hollis is sat by the window all night staring at his ghost in glass. These are the things that are running around in his mind, you know, that the farm is only to pay the bills and isn't moving them forward in any way. They're not getting, certainly not getting ahead, and they're not breaking even either. They're just existing. And, you know, off stage is the brother, and, you know, I'm sure a lot of people could relate to this when, you know, when one sibling is caring for parents and another isn't. I know this one pretty well. I think it's all there, like you say, but I think we feel the weight that Hollis feels in this paragraph, even though we don't know who Hollis is yet. We don't know what his deal is really, but we know what's on his mind anyway.
In the very next one, there's more to it. His mother would not bathe. We know that the father is blind. There are problems, more problems unfolding after we finish that first paragraph. But also we do know that we're in West Virginia. We know that the parsonage is at Harper's Ferry, for example. Whether you know anything about West Virginia or not, I suppose you're still in the story and you'll still get so much out of the story. But for me, there's like this extra layer with the setting of not just working on a farm, which is a very, very hard life, but then having to care for the parents and being on a farm that is a failed farm for all practical purposes. I mean, I think we can say that. And that he's pretty well locked out of the idea that his brother's going to help him, as we'll continue to learn. Peter, I read your essay Winter in September in the book, Am I Alone Here? And I've been thinking a lot about this idea of yours where you say, I've always resisted the notion of fiction as consolation. I've always seen it as something that is supposed to disrupt my life, to shake me out of treacherous contentment. You do go on, but there are days, mornings like these when it does provide a little solace, when reality itself, whatever this actually is, gets to be more than I can take. I think I really like this idea lately that it's very hard, I think, for a lot of us to go into fiction for consolation. Are we gluttons for punishment and looking for disruption in our lives? Not really. But there is something. I wonder if you still feel this way, and I wonder if you would talk about this idea of it's really not the job of the story to do this for us, but there is something that wakes us up to a reality that we don't maybe normally think about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's why, and we both are in the same camp on this, why you're in a certain mood or a certain point in a day or a life or a week, and you just wanna exist with somebody else who's also kind of enduring, You know, and I mean, I don't know if this, you know, and I think I was in a certain kind of mood, you know, in the last few days, and this is the kind of story that I reach for. I know you share this, and it's why we both love Gina Burial. There's certain writers who I think in their tone. I do remember writing an essay about this story. I didn't recall what I said. I don't look for fiction to increase my level of empathy, use it as a what sometimes where we're trying to sell this idea that, you know, if only people read fiction, they'd be better people. I mean, I'm just not sure that really bears out historically. We've been reading fiction for a long time. I think there's another reason we do it. I do think it has to do with being with people in the kind of silence that reading allows that. And here, this guy Hollis has nobody. He's got nobody. He's got a mother who's, you know, descending into, you know, kind of madness, dementia, whatever it is. The father is with it, but has become blind and now, you know, isn't able to care for himself. And he's cared for by his wife, who's barely able to do it. And I just think that this story captures sort of like that sense of how lonely it must be to be Hollis. And for some reason, you know, it feels okay to be with him right now. You know? I mean, I don't know.
I think so. I know you don't like me to read your words back to you,
No, I mean, I'm honored, I'm flattered, but it's like I didn't rereading this story. I didn't remember that most of the story is about squirrel hunting, and I don't think I even talked about that in the essay or not. You know, this story is tiny and yet pretty huge. And you know, he has more famous stories. He has arguably better stories, but this one, there's something about how he holds the mood. With Hollis sort of, you know, kind of thinking really dark thoughts, somehow feeling okay. You know, I don't know how, I forget how old DJ Pancake was when he wrote this story, but I mean, I assume he's in his late 20s, but he'd lived a lot of lives. Like this idea that he was like, I don't know, like some kind of neophyte in terms of experience in life. He'd been all over, he'd been out west, he'd done a lot of things in his life. And I think that may have somehow allowed him to like re-enter the, you know, those spaces that he knew best, which was a home in West Virginia, where he, you know, where he left. I mean, I think he always came back in his mind, but he, you know, wasn't there when he wrote this. Let's put it that way.
I was introduced to Pancake when I first read Am I Alone Here years ago before I even knew you. So thank you for introducing a lot of us to not just Pancake, but a lot of other writers. But you said stories fail if you read them only once. And I thought about that when I reread the story. And then you said, you've got to meet a story again and again in different moods, in different eras of your life. And this time, that really hit me because I have not read these stories in a very long time, and I am definitely in a different era in my life than the previous times that I've read these stories. You have this idea right at the top of the essay, and then the idea about resisting the notion of fiction as consolation. But then the other thing, too, is this. Pancake listened to the silence between his characters and also to the silence between sentences, between words. First Day of Winter is short, at least in terms of pages. And then you say the story is about aging, about responsibility. It is about the people we spend our lives living with, worrying over, and many other things that are so very resonant. It just hits home in a very different way. Later, you say something about, you said, rereading, I found I was wrong. His people talk more to each other than I'd remembered, because you have this thing about he didn't remember a lot of people talking in these stories, but they actually do in this one. But you say that it's a kind of a dialogue that is so intrinsic to the landscape of the story, you don't notice it as a separate entity. And I carried that idea even into some of the other stories that I read, and it's so true. It's just sort of the kind of thing you expect people to say, like, oh, there's cereal, or did you have breakfast, or did you, this kind of not meaningless, but this kind of dialogue that's just part of the day. The other thing too is about First Day of Winter and what even that title, the title of the story, holds on top of everything else. So yeah. So sorry, but yeah, I think your essays just always guided my reading of.
I mean, again, it sounds like somebody else. I guess I'm like, I found myself like, oh yeah, okay, I'll accept that. But then I knew this actually, because I knew reading this story that I was not, at least in part, wasn't going to relate to anything I thought about it earlier, mm-hmm. and I do kind of feel that way. I guess the idea of dialogue being part of landscape, okay, you know, maybe, but there's a line here, and this goes to, you know, how, you know, and I think hopefully everybody that we do on this, on The Lonely Voice, I feel like when you're on like Terry Gross and you have to repeat the title of your thing. Yeah. Well, Terry, in, you know, I'm looking at my friend Vivi Francis's postcard for her book, In the Shared World, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a line here that I positive that however many times I've read this story in the past, I never noticed it. And it's his father he's standing by the car, trying to figure out if he can make the car run. The car's got a cracked engine block, among many other things. Pancake is a wonderful writer of work. He understood just what it took to get up every day and work until mm-hmm. you were dropped. Mm-hmm. And these people, they need a car to get to town to get groceries, but the car doesn't run. And he's out there now trying to, you know, figure out if he can make it run. Mm-hmm. And his father has come out, his blind father has come out and says, "She sounded locked up," he said again. "Yeah," Hollis edged the man aside. Interesting, edged the man aside. Hmm. The father's described in another part of the story as the husband. It's a weird distance, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we should say that this writer never was alive to proofread or edit a final version of this story, at least in book form. I don't recall if this was a lot of his stories appeared in The Atlantic, or some anyway, and other magazines while he was alive, but I wonder if some of them were in manuscript on his desk. And so who knows what he would have done with them. You know what yeah. I mean? I think it's just important to point out. But this exchange, yeah, Hollis edged the man aside, shut the hood. He didn't have the tools to pull the engine and had no engine to replace it. Maybe Jake will loan you the money for a new car. That's what he says to his father. No, the old man said. We'll get by without bothering Jake. Put it on the cuff. Do you think the bank would give us another nickel? Jake has too much to worry with as it is. And this is the thing, like when you're reading the story, don't get too confident that the word that you think is going to come, because his people don't talk the way that you might talk, and you better pay attention, the same level of attention that he had. And so here's the lines I'm coming to. I asked him to take you all last night. Why? I asked him and Molly to take you in, and he said, "No, I'm stuck here. I can't make my own way for fighting a losing battle with this damn farm. Farming's making your way. Hell." And here's the line I've been focusing on. Everybody's trying for something better anymore. Everybody's trying for something better anymore. I mean, that's not what I read, even last night. And that's what's on the page. Everybody's trying for something better anymore. When everybody's going one way, it's time to turn back. Here's a writer who's not, he's listening, and it kind of goes back to what I guess I was trying to say 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. He's listening to his character so carefully that if you're not kind of reading, you know, as intensely or slowly or closely, you're going to miss it. And then there's another line here which also startled me, because I don't think I remember this one either. And I don't know. I mean, I would say, like, Pancake, would you have included this in the final? But he says this. He rationalized in five directions. That's the narrator talking. He rationalized in five directions. He's a blind man, so I kind of see him rationalizing in five directions. But it's an oddly abstract word, rationalized, right there. for a writer who's so in the moment. So he's surprising even now after reading a story that, I know the story pretty well, after reading it, I don't know, seven times in my life, but it's still kind of this, and if a writer can still surprise you after seven, eight times, then, that's somebody you're going to keep reading forever.
Every reading is different, just as you said in the essay, but just as you discovered and just as I discovered this time. And I'm going to tell you, I don't remember reading this the last couple of days. I've read this story maybe three times the last couple of days, and I don't remember that. I don't remember focusing on that. And another thing I want to point to that comes right before is what the story includes right before Hollis goes hunting. So we know it's Thanksgiving and there should be wild game. And Hollis has to work on the car. Outside, the air was sharp, and when the wind whipped against his face, he gasped. The sky was low, gray, and the few Angus he had kept from market huddled near the feeder beside the barn. He threw them some hay, brought his tool chest from the barn, began to work on the car. And it goes on. Hollis's knuckles were bloody, scraped under the raised hood, and they stung as he turned the key harder, gripped the wheel. His father's cane tapped through the frosty yard, the still of December, and came closer to Hollis. The blind man's mouth was shut against the cold, the dark air so close to his face, and Hollis stopped trying the engine, got out. And then the part that you read, but I was thinking about all the things he has to do in this moment, and everything's failing. And then that part, is so visceral for me for some reason. The knuckles were bloody, scraped under the, like, it's like extra painful or something. It's just extra horrible. And then when he says, he saw the old man's hair bending in the wind, come on inside, you'll catch cold. You going hunting like I asked? I'll go hunting. And then as he crossed the last pasture heading up toward the ridges, Hollis felt a sinking in his gut, a cold hunger. And it's not for the wild game, it's not for the Thanksgiving feast. It's about something else. So he's just gone through from sitting looking at his ghostly reflection to seeing his parents in the most stark reality of where they are in their lives, as older people, as people who can't take care of themselves like they used to, on this farm that's failing. Jake's not going to help him. The father is still sort of intruding, and it's like Hollis is thinking, like, oh my God, this is it. And he's going to go out there with his rifle and try to kill the squirrels. I don't know. There's just something about how it builds and builds. And then, of course, the hunting scene reveals even darker things to us about what he's thinking, what his brother has suggested to him about the nursing home. And it's all very dark. And and this is the other thing. This is very real. This is not like, oh, it's so dark. Like, I don't know people like that. No, there are people like this.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Because I agree with you and agree with you and agree with you, but I wonder if you also feel a kind of lifting in this story, and not just in the direct language, which in the paragraph you read, when he does step out to go hunting, there is this moment, a little at a time. Jake had sloughed everything to him, and now that his brother was away, just for this small moment, Hollis was happier. I don't use that as a total counterpoint, because I don't feel like there's like, oh, suddenly he's happy or anything. But I feel like there's something about this story, in contrast to others in this book, I think, where I do feel like and there's this rising. Things are really dire. But there's some reason, like, maybe this is going to sound cheesy, but the intensity of experience that Hollis is having suddenly, at least it feels that way to us, is somehow kind of a relief to him. And this is where I kind of feel the writer kind of like being along with him, like saying, like, look, your life is very, very tough, but you know what? I am watching it. I'm seeing it. I don't know, this sounds cheesy, but I do feel like there's this sort of sense of kind of just utter respect and love for these people, these characters. And not because I think he, from what I know about Breeze Pancake, he did want to give West Virginia its due in terms of literature, fine. But this is so good, it transcends any kind of regional, you know? And there was an example where you read it already. His father's cane tapped through the frosty yard, comma, the still of December, comma, and came closer to Hollis. Now I wrecked it by adding the commas, but that is such a, that like, that redirection. His father's cane tapped through the frosty yard, the still of December, and came closer to Hollis. It's like, it's almost like I've never, I don't know of another example where somebody in the middle of a sentence kind of comes in with almost a different voice, like another narrative voice, and says, you know, the father's cane is responding somehow to the still of December. It's just such a beautiful and strange and almost like courageous move for a writer who, again, who, you know, Joyce Carol Oates on the cover, a young writer of such extraordinary gifts that one is tempted to compare his debut to Hemingway's. I mean, okay, fair, you know, it's a nice blurb. Thank you, Joyce. You're very generous, as she was to this writer, as she was to, as she's been, as she is to so many writers, including myself, I gotta say. But like, this guy wasn't a young writer in quotes. This is somebody who's really in tune to what, to the scene, to the moment, to the, to the, to, I'm just going off the rails. We should, that's all nonsense. I'm sorry.
It's not. I totally hear what you're saying. You know, and in the next section where it just becomes this killing of the squirrels and dressing them as he has learned to do, and then it says that he gets tired. Killing drained him, and his game bag weighed heavily at his side. He rested against a tree near the thicket, stared into its dark wavings of needles and branches. There, almost blended with the red needles, lay a fox. He watched it without moving and thought of Jake, hidden, waiting for him to break, to move. In a fit of meanness, he snapped his rifle to his shoulder and fired. When he looked again, the fox was gone, and he caught a glimpse of its white-tipped tail drifting through the piney darkness. In that moment, it's like, it is such a beautiful moment, and I know people write about this moment with the fox, but it's Jake. You know, it's like he watched it without moving and thought of Jake hidden. So he puts so much, there's so much stock in Jake, and you know, Jake has all this power and control over his life, it seems, because he will not take in the parents. And this is what he's thinking about in this very beautiful moment. And then he turns it into a kind of a mean moment, but the fox escapes. That's also a very startling moment where all of a sudden he's thinking about Jake.
Yeah, and you know, I never equated to the idea that like he's like kind of putting his anger out on Jake, but it makes perfect sense that that's what he's doing there. And I don't want to ruin the story, but of course, you know, not much happens, everybody, you know, except this is more conversation. So they have their Thanksgiving dinner of squirrels, and the parents are very, very proud of Jake. And they are extremely excited. He sent a bunch of pictures of him and his family, and Hollis has to listen to this. And you know, I think Hollis loves his brother too. I don't not see that.
I agree.
And I think Hollis is home for reasons which we can probably imagine, you know, not just that he's there out of the goodness of his own heart to take care of his parents, but you know, I'm not sure Hollis has anywhere else to go, you know, but I don't know that for sure, but I'm just thinking. And it's just it's just a heartbreaking, gorgeous finish. And you know, I don't want to, well, maybe we shouldn't ruin this one and hope
Well,
that people get to it.
I agree, but I want to point to one thing, if I may. When he says, when, letter came from Jake, the old man held a hindquarter nod at it. And pictures of them, his mother got up, came back with a handful of snapshots. He done fine for himself. Looky at the pretty church and the children, she said. And then she says, that's my May Ellen. That's my favorite. Shouldn't have favorites. His father laid down the bones.
Right, exactly. I didn't think of that. I didn't get that either, but you're so right. And but I just, it's one of the great, falling into our hyperbole trap, it is one of the great endings, and I'm grateful that whoever, I don't remember how the book was actually put together. I think maybe by Grease Pancake's mother, or maybe he had a manuscript, that was roughly in place, but the choice to end the book on this story and to end on the last lines was such a great one. And maybe I guess I could read that without ruining it, right?
Yes.
He went back to the house, and in the living room, stretched out on the couch. Pulling the folded quilt to his chest, he held it there like a pillow against himself. He heard the cattle lowing to be fed, heard the soft rasp of his father's crying breath, heard his mother's broken humming of a hymn. He lay that way in the graying light and slept. The sun was blackened with snow, and the valley closed in quietly with humming, quietly as an hour of prayer.
Breeze DJ Pancake is the author of First Day of Winter. And here's a bonus episode. Peter Orner and I discuss another story by Breeze Pancake called Time and Again.
It'd be kind of fun to talk about a story which I think is sort of arguably one note, but I know you're not going to feel that way, but I think other people might. And so it might be kind of fun to talk about this horror story, quote unquote.
Yes, it's a horror
But
story.
yeah.
American Gothic style, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to argue slightly against that.
You are? I really want to, even the part where he says he has to clean the seat.
I'm just saying, like, it's not. I'll just say, I think, yes, it's a story about a guy who might very well kill people, but he's also a snowplow driver, and he's apparently a pretty good one, and he misses his kid, and he's got his hogs, and I just feel like it's not, and that's what makes it great. It's not a, I don't, and not that it would be a bad thing, to be like a genre story, whatever, but I feel like it's more than just a story about a potential serial killer.
Yeah, so we're talking about Time and Again.
Good. This is our bonus episode. It's just a quick look at Time and Again. It's not anything close to the power of the last story. It just isn't. This was a book that was not put together by the writer himself, and that maybe he might have said, you know what, Time and Again had its place, but it may not have its place in this book, but it fits also.
When I read this particular story, and I know you're going to talk about it, but I'm just going to get this out.
Yeah.
He's very, this is actually a very solitary person, and I can't really tell if he misses his wife or what happened to the wife. But the one thing that I'm always struck by is how annoyed he is with those people that line up behind him as he clears the road. Like, he just hates people. How else to say it? And his interaction with Mr. Weeks, his boss, is only sort of snowplow to snowplow. And you just see how disconnected he is from everyone except, and okay, that's, I just wanted to get that out. It's stuff everybody has said about the story probably, but I just, yes, that's sort of on the tip of my brain.
I mean, I'm just gonna say, like, I think of Scatman Crothers in The Shining, and what other pieces of art have feature snowplows except for a book I used to read my kid about the snowplow? Snowplow drivers are not necessarily. I don't think we can make an anthology of snowplow driver stories. I don't think there'd be enough. And so I am particularly appreciative of the attention that snow plowing gets in this story. And, I live in New Hampshire. I live in Vermont, but I work in New Hampshire, and I'm sitting in New Hampshire right now. And, I'm sometimes those people waiting for, we're so, like, we don't think about them. And then when there's a huge snowstorm, we can't move. There they are, these guys, mostly guys, I think. I think it must be, what a fascinating. My friend Grove is a snowplow driver in the winter, and I remember him talking about being out there, and just you're kind of like, it's lonely. But he also, I do remember him saying how beautiful it was when, because they can go into a falling snow, a snowstorm, you know what I mean, and experience it.
Yes.
And that's what this guy, if he is a killer, he's certainly one that has a little bit of sensitivity. As I plow down the grade towards chimney corners, my lights are the only ones on the road, and the snow takes up the yellow spinning of my dome light and the white curve of my headlights. I smile at the pretties they make, but I'm tired and I wish I was home. I worry about the hogs. I should have given them more slop, but when the first one dies, the other one will eat him quick enough. I think e even if it was a sort of a bit of a one-off, and it makes a move, which is a good, it's a good one. God knows it's a good one. But I guess my argument is it's better than a one-move story. The details alone make this writer always worth reading, and his way of how he knows how this works. Mr. Weeks always brags on what a good job I do, and when I meet the other truck plowing the uphill side of this road, I will honk. That will be Mr. Weeks coming up from Golly.
And then there's his reminiscing about being in France. And but what I want to say that popped into my head is that this is not a one of those one-off stories, because if it were, the hitchhiker would have had a different, I don't want to give everything away, but the hitchhiker would have ended up in a very different way.
It just shows you what even in, not every story writer is going to write a brilliant story every time, but they're always going to have an instinct that's
Yeah.
going to go in another direction. And I think that a killer who doesn't kill, let's just say, is kind of fascinating. And I'll be honest, I don't necessarily think that he is a killer. My own interpretation is that the conversation he has with the kid, and I don't know if we should go this deep in the story, but the conversation he has with the kid, it snowed like this in France the winter of 44, I say. I was in the paratroops, and they dropped us where the Germans were thick. My platoon took a farmhouse without a shot. Damn, he says. Did you knife them? Snap their necks, I say. And I see my man tumble into the sty. People die so easy. I think, and my argument is that it's that, and only that, that leads the driver in this case to imagine something. There's a lot that goes against that interpretation, and so I will say it's a wrong interpretation. But are there times when a reader can help out and make a good writer who isn't writing his greatest story? Can they help out and make that story better? That's what I'm arguing.
Oh, yeah. Because they're really, for me, there's just one single fragment of a sentence that pushes it the other way. The rest of the time, I'm all about the character saying, all the way up the mountain, and this is a first person story. I count the men in France and I have to stop and count again. I never get any farther than the night it snowed. Mr. Weeks passes me and honks, but I don't honk. Time and again, I tried to count and can't. The fact that he didn't honk back this time. I mean, to me, yeah, there's so much more going on, and it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of, I just think it's a story that I can see it sort of being, and I think it is anthologized in a book of Gothic tales. I think it could definitely apply there for sure, and it has a home there. But I also think that it's a story that it puts you there, puts you on the roads at night alone, and he does this a lot with his people, and so I think it's. I think there's a lot of individual lines that are great. It's not that we tend to do stories that are great. You know what I mean? And this is maybe an exception that we are doing a story that isn't truly great.
People like to talk about how it's based on the Mad Butcher, and they talk about like the duffel bag and the bones, and there's all this, but that sort of, there's a tension in the story that for me sort of melds into back into his own thinking about France and missing the sun and wanting to get back home and being so tired that all he wants to do is go home. somehow.
There was one line I wanted to point out, and it had to do with what you said. I know the stretch of I know the stretch from Route 60 from Anstead to Gauley. Just lines like that. I'll read anything that has that. You know what I mean? I know the stretch of Route 60 from Anstead to Gauley. The specific it's just it's so wonderful. I passed the rest stop at Hawk's Nest. As I plow down the grade towards Chimney Corners, my lights are the only ones on the road. I pull up beside my house. My hogs run from their shelter in the backyard and grunt at me. I stand by my plow and look at the first rims of light around Sewell Mountain through the snowy limbs of the trees. Cars hiss by on the clean road. The kitchen light still burns, and I know the house is empty. My hogs stare at me, snort beside their trough. They're waiting for me to feed them, and I walk to their pen. And one thing, if I could add one thing, is that the story suggests that it's going to be about looking for the lost son. And I do think that the story is about a lost son, and I feel the weight of that, and so that too deepens the story for me and makes it better in my mind than it might be on the page. But this, when Mr. Weeks doesn't call, I write everybody I know about my boy. Some of my letters always come back. And again, it's just paying attention. Like, some of my letters always come back. Some of my letters always come back. That's, like an English teacher would, of course, correct that. But I get it. Some of my letters always come back. That is 100% right in this instance. Some of my letters always come back, right? And the folks who write back say nobody knows where he got off to. I can't help but think he might come home at night when I am gone. So I let the kitchen light burn and go on out the door.
Bryce DJ Pancake is the author of the stories First Day of Winter and Time and Again. The essay, Winter in September, can be found in the memoir and essays Am I Alone Here? By Peter Orner. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. Read more about Peter Orner and The Lonely Voice at tpr.org/The Lonely Voice. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.